are you now? You're mature.
Mature? I'm not mature. I'm just derelict. Look inside, I'm the same as I ever was.
What you're about to hear is a conversation with and brand new music from Pete Townsend. 1993 is a landmark year for Pete Townsend with the release of a new album, Psycho Derelict. In the tradition of Tommy and Quadrophenia, Psycho Derelict is more than just a batch of songs. It is, in fact, a play combining actors, dialogue, and music. The central figure is Ray High, a rock star who's been around for more than just a couple of years. And Pete, since we have the honor of having you here to discuss this new project, tell us first off, is Psycho Derelict autobiographical?
Well, obviously, every writer, every individual that creates has to draw on their own experiences. And when I set out to write songs, I do that, you know, I shoot from the hip. I don't actually write for any particular voice, except that I'm always writing for, the first commission that I ever had, you know, the Shepherd's Bush Who fan who was so delighted when I wrote Can't Explain and My Generation and Anyway, Anyhow, Anywhere, and came up and said, listen, that's what we need. That's what we want to say. That's what we want to say to the establishment and to the world. And I've been fairly faithful to that all the way along. So I tend to write songs for where those people are at today. You know, they're older. They're my age. They're married, divorced. Some of them are dead. Some of them have families. Some of them don't. Some of them have kids. Some of them, you know, some of them have made money. Some of them are poverty stricken. And so I'm still writing for them and for their relationships and you know, about their lives. But the play here is actually addressing things which I've learned, which I bring my experience to. So I thought, you know, listening through to the songs, I thought that maybe what I should do is I should give my personal take on it. So to that extent, it's autobiographical. But to the extent that I always write for that Shepherd's Bush kid, if this is sort of chapter 26 in his continuing story, then this is the usual kind of 80-20 breakdown. It's 80% my take on other people's lives.
That song, English Boy, which opens the album, that sounds like maybe it wasn't written for just those Shepherd's Bush kids, your generation.
You know, that's written for the whole gang. That's written for a lot of modern kids. You know, we have Public Enemy come to the UK and do very, very well, and Ice-T and people like that. But what we don't actually have at the moment is I don't think we have a rock and roll voice which is loud enough to protest at the way that boys are put on soapboxes and pointed at, and people say, there you are, that's what's wrong with society. These guys, you know, in the woolly hats, you know, in the woolly scarves on the football terraces, you know, they carry knives, you know. That's what's wrong with society. You know, it's society that's wrong with society. That's what the song's about. The boys are a product of it. I think what was so great about the generation that I was brought up with, why we were so lucky, was that we were the first people to kind of loudly protest, and they had to listen, you know, but they've stopped listening now.
In Psycho Derelict, we'll meet three main characters, Ray High, Rastus, and Ruth Streeting. Can you give a thumbnail sketch of each one of these characters?
I've tried to allow there to be depth in it, because I think the ultimate depth that's there is that this is relationships. These are people. They're metaphors superficially. You know, Ray is like a celebrity, you know, a smart ass, a know-all. Rastus is an unfeeling showbiz, you know, Colonel Parker guy, you know, goose him up with steroids and get him out there, you know. And Ruth is a hard-assed, cynical, smart journalist who's going to make her fortune by crushing other people. But in actual fact, what's really going on here is this is a team. This is what they call in pharmacy land symbiosis. You know, they cannot exist without one another.
Are you Harold Pinter?
No card, I think. Let's get the tenacious put on it. Let's get portentous and embroidered effects.
Extraordinary. Yes, residents being shot immediately.
Skip to
I've had an idea for a song called Pretentious for a long time, because I just like the idea of that, you know, I had my moment of courageous pretentiousness, you know, jumping in with Tommy. It felt very pretentious at the time to be writing something that was a song cycle, let alone something that then later became known as a rock opera. So I've never, you know, I've never had a problem with people that call me pretentious. Never. I don't regard it as an insult. But in the context of the piece, the song is actually about what Ray feels is the setting for his manager and the journalist's lifestyle. He feels that it's frippery, it's fluff, it's puff, to use the modern expression.
I don't know much, but I know what I like. I don't know much, now so and so said such and such. I don't know much, but I know what I like. I don't know much. It's pretentious, put on an act. It's people pretentious and boy, a fact. Saturated, just sucked up bland. It's overrated that the critics be dead.
The problem that Ray High has is he has a creative vision. He has something that he wants to, an idea that he feels has been lost in you know, the sequins and glitter and nonsense of the 70s. You know, a dream that was maybe rooted in the 60s, a good dream, a good idea, a good take, a good feeling about what rock and roll was going to do, what music was going to do, what young people were going to do in that first flush of 60s rock, which was then somehow forgotten in the 70s. What I'm asking the audience to do in the story is to look at what Ray is really saying when he's saying, you know, I can't do it, or, you know, I do it again, I can't discover it all over again. You know, you only get one opportunity to do something for the first time, and somehow we blew it. I don't know how, but, you know, when I look back at the 60s and 70s, you know, when punk came along, it was absolutely vital and necessary. If it hadn't, you know, we wouldn't have any rock and roll today, I'm convinced of it.
When we get to the midpoint of Psycho Derelict, a lot has happened to the three main characters, and surprisingly, we find Ray High telling Rosalind, the letter-writing fan, that he is in fact in love with Ruth, the journalist. Now that's a twist. Can you recap the events in Psycho Derelict that have brought Ray to this point?
He's received letters from a fan, and he's responded. And he's responded by saying to the fan, I know how you feel. But we don't know what the fan says to him. We know that she sent him an erotic photograph of some sort. We know that she was naked in the photograph. But we don't know what kind of photograph it is. We don't know how suggestive it is, because, you know, he never actually specifically states what kind of photograph it is. He might be making it up. She might never have sent him a photograph. And what we know is that at some point he twists and changes, and he kind of nurtures this fan. And then he suddenly just says to her, that's it, I'm not going to write to you anymore. I've sent you a song, I'm not going to write to you anymore. And the reason he gives is that I've fallen in love with this journalist.
With a project like Psycho Derelict, does Pete Townsend write the story first or the music?
The story was written after the music. I had the album finished as an album of songs, and I delivered it, and then had the cycling accident. I don't mean a motorbike, I was on a pedal bike, and I had a bad accident. I fell off and really smashed my wrist up, you know. And I think if they had invented a nylon wrist joint, I would be using it because my wrist is very, very bad. But for a long time, I thought I wouldn't play the guitar again. I didn't think I'd be able to type. I mean, one doctor I spoke to said that I might have difficulty even writing. With my right hand, this is, and I'm right-handed. So I decided almost to drop the whole thing. So when I came back to it all, to give it a last stab, it was a process of rediscovery, and I was kind of coming at it as like as though it was the last thing that I was ever going to do. So I decided to enlist my friend Richard Barnes, who wrote this book, Maximum R&B, about The Who, back in 82. And I asked him to consult. So I wrote scripts, and I'd throw them at him, and he'd blue-pencil them and tell me this was happening, that was happening, and we honed it down to the finely edited form that you have. So, the story definitely came afterwards. But I think the story was always there, because I'd written the songs around a theme. The theme was, what is the difference between facts and truth? In society, in the press, in music business, in my life, and in rock and roll.
Did you ever get letters like the ones Ray is getting from Rosalind?
All artists get letters from girls. Didn't you know that? And they're kind of weird letters. You know what women are. I don't keep all of the letters that I get, but I've kept some pretty wild ones. I haven't always answered the crazy ones because they're actually too difficult to answer. And you know, I suppose the craziest letters that I've had have actually been from men because I get more letters from men. Well, I used to. Fans often write to you and say, you know, I just wrote a letter to this journalist who panned your album, and I told him, you know, or her, you know, what the truth really is, and here is a copy of their article and here is a copy of my letter. As an artist, both of the documents are really painful to read. Because as an artist, up to that point, you would never have seen the original critique, and you would never have seen the fact that it ever had any effect. If you'd have only seen the article, you would never have known that anybody had read it. You would have thought, well, obviously, nobody's going to believe that. But the fact that this fan has responded so vehemently shows that they share your terror that the critic has power. So the fan and the critic become one in the eyes, to some extent, of the performer. They become one body. They are the people for whom you do your stuff.
I'll see you tomorrow. I might be a bit late, but I will be there this time. So call me back tonight, anyway. Okay?
After that last song we just heard called I Am Afraid, the play continues to unfold. There are several more songs, and as we approach the end, one has to wonder, did Ray High triumph?
You decide. I don't know. I don't know whether Ruth and Rastus have pulled off the coup, whether Ray knew that Ruth was Rosalind or Rosalind was Ruth, whether in fact there really is a Rosalind. We don't know that. We don't know whether Ruth has actually used the song that Ray sent or not. We don't know whether that Flame, the song that we hear Ruth sing, Rosalind is actually sung by Rosalind, and she's taken Rosalind's song and paid her off in San Francisco or shot her. We don't know whether Ray wrote it. None of these things are stated, and that's deliberate. You know, I want to leave that open. That's for you to decide. There were two songs that I wrote together, you see. Fake It and Don't Try and Make Me Real were written together. What they were supposed to be was a conversation between a man and a woman. And the way that men and women traditionally seem to fall into stereotypes of requirement in relationships, the man says often, don't try and put me in a pocket. If I say I love you, it doesn't mean I love you. It was something I just said at the time, you know. And in Fake It, a woman saying, I don't care if you really love me, bring me flowers, touch me, hold me, you know, because it's now that matters to me. You know, you're passing through my life from one end to the other, you know, grab me as you're passing, and I don't care if it's not true. You tell me anyway. In the play, Fake It becomes about information, about law, about justice, about orgasm, rather than just about, you know, say you love me, and, you know, and that will get me through the day.
There you go, Ruth. There's your cut. 5% at 60 grand.
Pete, as the author and composer of Psychoderelict, do you have any last thoughts on what the message contained in Psychoderelict is?
What I think it really is, what I think Psychoderelict is watch out. We've been down this pathway before. There was a revolution in the 70s. It was driven by psychedelic drugs. It changed society. And a lot of those changes were fun, and a lot of them have been lasting. But most of them were really, really quite horrible, I think. And certainly it produced wonderful music for a short period of time, but in the end it produced this undermining of what I believe was so wonderful about early rock and roll, the fact that, you know, it gave people who were fairly inarticulate and frustrated and lost and isolated a voice. And I'm asking, is Ray right to long for that? I don't long for it. Well, obviously, every writer, every individual that creates has to draw on their own experiences. And when I set out to write songs, I do that, you know, I shoot from the hip. I don't actually write for any particular voice, except that I'm always writing for, you know, the first commission that I ever had, you know, the Shepherd's Bush Who fan who was so delighted when I wrote Can't Explain and My Generation and Anyway, Anyhow, Anywhere and came up and said, listen, that's what we need. That's what we want to say. That's what we want to say to the establishment and to the world. And I've been fairly faithful to that all the way along. So I tend to write songs for where those people are at today. You know, they're older. They're my age. They're married, divorced. Some of them are dead. Some of them have families. Some of them don't. Some of them have kids. Some of them, you know, some of them have made money. Some of them are poverty stricken. And so I'm still writing for them and for their relationships and, you know, about their lives. But the play here is actually addressing things which I've learned, which I bring my experience to. So I thought, you know, listening through to the songs, I thought that maybe what I should do is I should give my personal take on it. So to that extent, it's autobiographical. But to the extent that I always write for that Shepherd's Bush kid, if this is sort of chapter 26 in his continuing story, then this is the usual kind of 80-20 breakdown. It's 80% my take on other people's lives. You know, that's written for the whole gang. That's written for a lot of modern kids. You know, we have Public Enemy come to the UK and do very, very well, and Ice-T and people like that. But what we don't actually have at the moment is I don't think we have a rock and roll voice which is loud enough to protest at the way that boys are put on soapboxes and pointed at, and people say, there you are, that's what's wrong with society. These guys, you know, in the woolly hats, you know, in the woolly scarves on the football terraces, you know, they carry knives, you know. That's what's wrong with society. You know, it's society that's wrong with society. That's what the song's about. The boys are a product of it. I think what was so great about the generation that I was brought up with, why we were so lucky, was is that we were the first people to kind of loudly protest, and they had to listen. You know, they had to, but they've stopped listening now. I've tried to allow there to be depth in it, because I think the ultimate depth that's there is that this is relationships. These are people. They're metaphors superficially. You know, Ray is like a celebrity, you know, a smart ass, a know-all. Rastus is an unfeeling showbiz, you know, Colonel Parker guy, you know. Goose him up with steroids and get him out there, you know. And Ruth is a hard-assed, cynical, smart journalist who's going to make a fortune by crushing other people. But in actual fact, what's really going on here is this is a team. This is what they call in pharmacy land symbiosis. You know, they cannot exist without one another. I've had an idea for a song called Pretentious for a long time, because I just like the idea of that, you know, I had my moment of courageous pretentiousness, you know, jumping in with Tommy. It felt very pretentious at the time to be writing something that was a song cycle, let alone something that then later became known as a rock opera. So I've never, you know, I've never had a problem with people that call me pretentious. Never. I don't regard it as an insult. But in the context of the piece, the song is actually about what Ray feels is the setting for his manager and the journalist's lifestyle. He feels that it's frippery, it's fluff, it's puff, to use the modern expression. The problem that Ray High has is he has a creative vision. He has something that he wants to, an idea that he feels has been lost in you know, the sequins and glitter and nonsense of the 70s. You know, a dream that was maybe rooted in the 60s. A good dream, a good idea, a good take, a good feeling about what rock and roll was going to do, what music was going to do, what young people were going to do in that first flush of 60s rock, which was then somehow forgotten in the 70s. What I'm asking the audience to do in the story is to look at what Ray is really saying when he's saying, you know, I can't do it, or, you know, I do it again, I can't discover it all over again. You know, you only get one opportunity to do something for the first time, and somehow we blew it. I don't know how, but, you know, when I look back at the 60s and 70s, you know, when punk came along, it was absolutely vital and necessary. If it hadn't, you know, we wouldn't have any rock and roll today, I'm convinced of it. He's received letters from a fan, and he's responded. And he's responded by saying to the fan, I know how you feel. But we don't know what the fan says to him. We know that she sent him an erotic photograph of some sort. We know that she was naked in the photograph. But we don't know what kind of photograph it is. We don't know how suggestive it is, because, you know, he never actually specifically states what kind of photograph it is. He might be making it up. She might never have sent him a photograph. And what we know is that at some point he twists and changes, and he kind of nurtures this fan. And then he suddenly just says to her, that's it, I'm not going to write to you anymore. I've sent you a song, I'm not going to write to you anymore. And the reason he gives is that I've fallen in love with this journalist. The story was written after the music. I had the album finished as an album of songs, and I delivered it, and then had the cycling accident. I don't mean a motorbike, I was on a pedal bike, and I had a bad accident. I fell off and really smashed my wrist up, you know. And I think if they had invented a nylon wrist joint, I would be using it, because my wrist is very, very bad. But for a long time, I thought I wouldn't play the guitar again. I didn't think I'd be able to type. I mean, one doctor I spoke to said that I might have difficulty even writing. With my right hand, this is, and I'm right-handed. So I decided almost to drop the whole thing. So when I came back to it all, to give it a last stab, it was a process of rediscovery, and I was kind of coming at it as though it was the last thing that I was ever going to do. So I decided to enlist my friend Richard Barnes, who wrote this book, Maximum R&B, about The Who, back in 82. And I asked him to consult. So I wrote scripts, and I'd throw them at him, and he'd blue pencil them and tell me this was happening, that was happening, and we honed it down to the finely edited form that you have. So, the story definitely came afterwards. But I think the story was always there, because I'd written the songs around a theme. The theme was, what is the difference between facts and truth? In society, in the press, in music business, in my life, and in rock and roll. All artists get letters from girls. Didn't you know that? And they're kind of weird letters. You know what women are. I don't keep all of the letters that I get, but I've kept some pretty wild ones. I haven't always answered the crazy ones, because they're actually too difficult to answer. And you know, I suppose the craziest letters that I've had have actually been from men, because I get more letters from men. Well, I used to. Fans often write to you and say, you know, I just wrote a letter to this journalist who panned your album, and I told him, you know, or her, you know, what the truth really is, and here is a copy of their article and here is a copy of my letter. As an artist, both of the documents are really painful to read. Because as an artist, up to that point, you would never have seen the original critique, and you would never have seen the fact that it ever had any effect. If you'd have only seen the article, you would never have known that anybody had read it. You would have thought, well, obviously, nobody's going to believe that. But the fact that this fan has responded so vehemently shows that they share your terror that the critic has power. So the fan and the critic become one in the eyes, to some extent, of the performer. They become one body. They are the people for whom you do your stuff. You decide, I don't know. I don't know whether Ruth and Rastus have pulled off the coup, whether Ray knew that Ruth was Rosalind or Rosalind was Ruth, whether in fact there really is a Rosalind. We don't know that. We don't know whether Ruth has actually used the song that Ray sent or not. We don't know whether that Flame, the song that we hear Ruth sing, Rosalind is actually sung by Rosalind, and she's taken Rosalind's song and paid her off in San Francisco or shot her. We don't know whether Ray wrote it. None of these things are stated, and that's deliberate. You know, I want to leave that open. That's for you to decide. There were two songs that I wrote together, you see. Fake It and Don't Try and Make Me Real were written together. What they were supposed to be was a conversation between a man and a woman. And the way that men and women traditionally seem to fall into stereotypes of requirement in relationships, the man says often, don't try and put me in a pocket. If I say I love you, it doesn't mean I love you. It was something I just said at the time, you know. And in Fake It, a woman saying, I don't care if you really love me. Bring me flowers. Touch me. Hold me. You know, because it's now that matters to me. You know, you're passing through my life from one end to the other. You know, grab me as you're passing. And I don't care if it's not true. You tell me anyway. In the play, Fake It becomes about information, about law, about justice, about orgasm, rather than just about, you know, say you love me, you know, and that will get me through the day. What I think it really is, what I think Psychedelic is watch out. We've been down this pathway before. There was a revolution in the 70s. It was driven by psychedelic drugs. It changed society, and a lot of those changes were fun, and a lot of them have been lasting, but most of them were really, really quite horrible, I think. And certainly it produced wonderful music for a short period of time, but in the end it produced this undermining of what I believe was so wonderful about early rock and roll, the fact that, you know, it gave people who were fairly inarticulate and frustrated and lost and isolated a voice. And I'm asking, is Ray right to long for that? I don't long for it. It was made at my home studio. It was made on a boat, which is part of my studio complex near my house on the River Thames. And it's a big old Dutch barge. And that's my demo studio now. Yeah, I workshopped the writing of the play with actors. Originally, there were a lot more characters. I think there were about 10. And then I started to hone them down. And we consulted with various actors. Michael Cerveris, who's the lead in Tommy, came over and helped me with some of those workshops. He actually, for a while, had a part on the record, but unfortunately he was one of the parts that I finally cut. Jan Ravens, who is the woman who plays Ruth Streeting, was the most useful in workshops, I think, because she's a radio producer, an actress, and a writer. And she was really valuable, helpful to me. I used my usual group of musicians. I like to have the same people that I used on Chinese Eyes. Jody Lynn Scott on percussion, Peter Hope Evans on harmonica, John Bundrick Rabbit on keyboards, and if I can get them, Mark Brzecki or Simon Phillips on drums, Pino Palladino or somebody like him on bass, and nowadays I like to have a guitar player around. We kicked off with that group of people and they played along with the things that either I was doing in the studio or that were on tape. And then I started to finish the tracks off. I suppose I play really about 80% of the music on it, because some of the stuff that they played I dumped, you know. But I like them there for spiritual reasons. Yeah, I think predictable is also about somebody saying, what I like about you is that I know what's going to happen. I know what's going to happen. You know, I know I'm not going to have an orgasm. but I like that, you know, or I know how it's going to feel. You know, I know how it's going to go today. You know, and that is what makes it exciting, is that I'm certain that it's going to go a certain way, and often it doesn't, maybe. I don't know. No, I'm not wildly anxious to get back up on the stage because I'm not wildly keen to be a performer. I don't feel comfortable as a performer particularly. I'm much happier as a writer or a band member. It's ironic for me that after years in The Who, being frustrated because I couldn't, you know, express what I felt I needed to express because the band was such a big force and had such a big personality and I had to write for it, that I left, got my moment of kind of personal freedom, said my piece, and then missed the fact that whenever I go on a stage now, I'm in the front. You know, it's like it's hard work. You have to write it and have to carry the show as well. So this isn't quite like that. This, I would be one of the people in the show. I would have my little rests. I think it would be quite good for me. And I think that I feel comfortable that I could do this, where I don't necessarily feel that I could do a tour of just me solo, you know, like a two-hour show with me jumping about all over the place. You know, I don't find performing hard. That's the other thing. It doesn't, you know, what Roger does as a performer is so much bigger and harder than what I do. He takes on the whole audience, you know, and he makes a pact with them when he walks on, is I am going to hold your attention for 2 hours and I'm going to give you every ounce of adrenaline and blood and guts in my body. You know, I go out there and say, hi, guys, you know, what you get is what you see is what you get. You know, and if you like it, fine. And if you don't, then f*** off. You know, I'm a working musician. That's how I see myself. I really do. I really do. I see myself as a working musician. I was in a band. And it's the writing that's made me a bit of an icon as a performer. As a solo artist, I've only done 2-3 shows in my life. Really. I've hardly done anything. As a solo performer, I don't exist, really, so I've got no career. So this is a big moment for me. If I actually do this, this will be the first solo tour that I've ever done. And it'll be small, but it'll still be a big moment for me.